Summer reading is the subject today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Roald and I are ready to read. Are you? Meanwhile, Garrison Keillor is ready with the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. I noticed my spell check decided your name is Ronald rather than
nobody
Roald.
Believes me.
Yeah, well, it's a unique name.
Well, it isn't.
Well, it isn't unique in Norway, Roald.
Well, Roald Dahl?
Roald Dahl, that's right.
Right.
You're not the only Roald, but of course you're our special Roald.
Yes.
But summer, well, we're getting down to the end of summer, heading into the final month and so on. So I guess,
well,
do people read during vacation?
You know, the New York Times and other places have come out with what they call summer reading. Are you in favor of that? As if you should read easier works, right? Romances and other things like that.
Well, I never read romances anyway. But the thing is, when I go on vacation, my family finds it depressing because all I want to do is read, eat, and sleep.
But do you read it? Do you read different books in the summer?
No, I just read the next book.
Right. To me, summer reading, summer's the time to read heavy books, right? Because theoretically you have a little more time and you're on vacation.
Well, that's when I read heavy books, and I've got one for you here, which
I'm
going to pass over to you. It's called The Lexicographer's Dilemma by Jack Lynch, The Evolution of Proper English from Shakespeare to South Park. It is the soap opera story of the ongoing battle between prescriptive and descriptive English. The grammarians fight. And I must say, Roald, you and I have argued about this a long time.
Yes, we.
I have tended to be rather more prescriptive, and you are a little more descriptive, but neither one of us is entirely in the, you know, has both feet in that one camp. But this is good. This covers the ground.
All right.
I mean, every bit of it. And you get down to, there's even a wonderful chapter on here in here called Sabotage in Springfield. Philip Gove stokes the flames, Webster's Third International Dictionary. You remember the furor.
Well, you know what? It's interesting. To the 39 years that I taught English at Augustana, the freshman texts that we used, and we used a lot of different ones because none of them ever seemed to work out very well, they started out being very prescriptive.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This is right. This is what is correct. And this is what you're going to be graded on your papers. By the time I retired, textbooks for freshman English seemed to side with a student. I can remember one that I've mocked and made fun of all the time, even though I'm more descriptive than prescriptive. And it's called It's Mine and I'll Write It That Way. And the gist is, what gives the teacher the right to put red marks on your paper? That's the way you want to say it. You know, and
but I was teaching speech, you know, I remember an instance came up, and I can't recall exactly why, about the importance of saying words, but conveying meaning. You've got to convey meaning so people understand you. And Dizzy Dean at that time was doing the color on Cardinal games. And I said, Dizzy Dean says he slid into third. Now, people know what he means.
Right.
People know what he means. You could quibble with the fact that slud is not a word.
Well,
But it worked. It worked for him. And the important thing is to convey meaning. You know, when you're speaking, people must understand what you're saying. And if you want to cut corners like that or speak in language that they will find comprehensible and maybe even amusing, go ahead. And I'm not going to stop you.
Well, good. You're coming around, Don.
That was in speech, sir. No, but I must concede that the descriptive grammarians are right. You can't control language.
No, and cultures that have tried to do it, French, Norwegians, and others, Icelandics, are trying to do it now.
Right? What I found interesting in that book is the fact that we got to this point because the first people who were trying to apply rules to English were Latin scholars, and they were applying the rules of Latin to English. And if there's a one language that's not going to fit with English, it's Latin. And that's where we began to get the rules.
Or even the rules of math. You know, you and I both grew up absolutely being forbidden to use two negatives, right? Because two negatives make a positive.
Although Shakespeare does.
Well, they do it. And so does Chaucer. And they do it for double emphasis,
yeah.
Right? So what's wrong with, "I'm sorry, ma'am, I ain't got no bananas," isn't that the meaning is not there, right? You understand that guy's meaning.
Yes, that's
true. It's that he's...
But proper speech, there are people who, and I tend to be one of them, I want speech to be proper. I like good English. I like good writing.
Yeah, but that's not even true. If you go into a shop, right, there is such a thing called shop English. And people don't use the same grammar in shop English that they use in secretarial English.
That's true. We understand, I don't apply these rules to others. I apply them to myself. I'm constantly critiquing my own because I'm not a natural writer.
Right.
And so I worry about
that. As your situation changes, your English probably doesn't change very much.
Yeah, that's true. But
so that you probably sound snooty to some kinds of people you talk to.
Well, I certainly found out when I started writing that column back in 86, I go back and look at it and I think, oh my goodness, how stilted, you know. Loosen up, write the way you speak, and you'll be fine. But when I started writing, it became very formal. I've learned to get away from that now, because writing was just not natural to me. I could talk all day long, as you've noticed, but the writing, But let's talk about books. You have a recommendation for some?
I thought it would be interesting. I have about 4 pages of recommendations.
Oh, dear.
And to list them would take longer than we have.
Short.
But I thought this summer in August, the Figge Art Museum has a very interesting exhibit. I think in 1986 or thereabouts, a young Dutch photographer came down the Mississippi River and taking photographs of people and places along the way, including the Quad Cities. And that album of photographs that he took apparently in Holland solidified his reputation as a great photographer. And just last summer, his daughter made the same trip and took photographs from exactly the same places as his photographs, including some of the same people that he interviewed, only now they're 30 years older, and talked to them about it. So that you have a photographic exhibit at the Figge in August about this trip down the river. This guy goes all the way to New Orleans, but it's really interesting. And so I thought it would be fun. There are so many great books that involve trips down the Mississippi River. You know, who was it? Heraclitus said, "No man steps into the same river twice."
Mm-hmm.
But it's fact that that no river releases the same man from the river that went into the river either.
That's
you
true.
Are changed by the river. And you've got trips down the river. I suppose the most famous is probably Twain's Life on the Mississippi River. But there's Charles Dickens, who came and found the river despicable. He couldn't stand it. He thought it was ugly. He thought it was muddy. He thought it was sickly. Many people in the Quad Cities know that one of Dickens' sons is buried in Riverside Cemetery in Moline.
Yeah.
You can still visit his grave. The guy that wrote Pajama Game, I forget, 7.5 Cents, the musical, wrote a book called A Stretch on the River. He lives in Dubuque, which attempts to correct Twain on Twain's view of the river. Paul Meinke, who was a Channel 4 guy, just came through the river yesterday on a voyage all the way from Lake Itasca down to New Orleans and stopped to talk to people. One of the most interesting trips down the river are the foreigners who came over, not just Dickens, but Captain Marryat and Harriet Martineau, LaSalle, Marquette, and Joliet. You couldn't do a better thing, I think, than start reading books about the trip down the river and then go over and see that exhibit at the Figge. Let me just give you one example. In 1844-45, a Swedish novelist, Fredrika Bremer, the most famous novelist in Sweden at the time, on her own came out and went to the Falls of St. Anthony and began a trip down the river to New Orleans. At the Falls of St. Anthony, she was met by Henry Sibley, the territorial governor, and her account is just absolutely priceless. He took her to a wigwam, and inside there were about four Sioux Indians around the campfire, drying meat and stuff. And then around the edge, there were Sioux women making stuff out of deer skin and so forth. And she thought, oh, what a happy scene this is, this loving little family scene, and compared to cold Swedish men, right?
Uh-huh.
and then as she was leaving, she counted, well, there were 4 men and 8 women. so is it one cold Swedish man or one half of a warm Indian? And by the time she gets to New Orleans, as gradually slavery dawns on her and its effects,
mm-hmm.
It's just brilliant. She stops by here just as the trial for Ruth, the guy that shot Erik Jansen at Bishop Hill, is on trial, and talks about that trial. She stays with friends in Moline. These trips down the river are just amazing.
What's the name of that book?
I can't remember the name, but the Augie Library has a copy, and so I think. Look up Fredrika Bremer, Bremer. It's a two-volume memoirs of her incredible journey down the river.
Well, you have been a Mississippi-centered guy as long as I've known you.
Can I mention one other river book?
Yes, one other river book.
A book of Melville's that almost nobody ever reads is called The Confidence Man, and it's an anti-Moby Dick. It begins at New Orleans on April 1st, April Fool's Day, and two con men get on a steamboat and make a trip all the way up the Mississippi River, conning people along the way in various guises. In every chapter, they're different. In one, they're cleverly disguised as Emerson and his disciple Thoreau. It is a funny book, but it is devastating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Given the affirmative view of life that you get in Moby Dick, this is a dark book. But it is just a great book. The Confidence Man by Herman Melville.
How about that? Well, I've got something slight to recommend. If you want light summer reading, Gary Elwes came to everyone's attention as the hero in Wesley in The Princess Bride, a very popular movie. One of those movies that has become more popular as time has gone on. They had a big 25th anniversary event in New York about this, and Elwes has written a book about making the movie, and various people who are in the movie also add their comments along the way. It is a delightful movie, and ripping through this book, it's an easy read. I decided, yeah, I've got to see the movie again, because I enjoyed the book, the original book, The Princess Bride, which, by the way, is fun to read, much more there than in the movie. But that and the movie are worth your attention on an idle summer day. We have a lot more to talk about, but we're going to take a break right now and let Garrison Keillor have his say. Then we'll come back, and I have some more serious suggestions on summer reading. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Talking about summer reading, you mentioned, you know, reading serious books in the summer, and I'd like to recommend three that if you were concerned about our political life, there are three books that I would recommend to you if you really want to understand things. The one has been out for almost a couple of years now, Dark Money. It is the most thorough explanation of how we have come to where we are and what the political world is like in this country. The best explanation I have ever read. People who are dinged by it challenge it, but you can't shake the facts of it. It is really a good piece of reporting. If you've worried about health care, and that seems to be an ongoing argument, a new book is out by Elizabeth Rosenthal called An American Sickness: How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. It is a very intriguing book, and it goes into great detail about exactly how our healthcare industry has become a runaway profit center. And I don't know, even looking at the book, if you find an easy answer for that, because there are great pressures on keeping things the way they are. Then if you're concerned about taxes, T.R. Reid has his opinion on it, and I think it's not going to be a perfect answer, but it's called A Fine Mess: A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. People get all excited about taxes, but taxation is democracy. There is no free lunch. You don't have a society of any kind without someone picking up the bill. And it's better for those who receive the benefits to pay the bill. And if all of us do that, then there's a better chance our government is going to be fairer. But those are three books on serious subjects you might want to look at. The essential one is Dark Money. Then the Fine Mess about taxation, and also An American Sickness, which has to do with the health system. Those are serious books I would recommend for your attention. The one on grammar that I talked about early, we'll just have Roel read that.
Well, then if those are too heavy for you, or after reading them you want something a little light, I know some of you are already fans of Alan Bradley, the mystery writer whose detective is 11-year-old Flavia DeLuce, a genius at chemical potions and things like that, who solves incredible mysteries. And his latest one is called Thrice Hath the Brinded Cat Mewed, from Macbeth, of course. Uh-huh. And it is an old-fashioned British mysteries in many ways, except that Flavie DeLuce is not your typical detective. But she's come home, or been kicked out of boarding school, in fact, come home to the family estate from a girls' school in Canada, where they've shipped her to kind of shape her up. And it's got all the kinds of things you expect in one of those old-fashioned British mysteries. There's the mansion, there's the butler, there's the old man of the house who is dying. There are the relatives, the hangers-on, the staff, and all kinds of mysteries surrounding it. And Flavie DeLuce puts her chemical set to use and solves the mystery. If you've never read a Flavie DeLuce novel, I would recommend reading an Alan Bradley book. They're good.
What's the name of this one?
Thrice Hath the Brinded Cat Mewed.
Okay, Thrice Hath the
Brinded. From the witches in Shakespeare.
Here's an interesting pairing that I found absolutely engrossing, and it's an easy read. It's called Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom by Thomas E. Ricks. It's a story of Churchill during the Second World War and through his final years, and George Orwell, who wrote Animal Farm in 1984. Two were the two books, particularly 1984, that will not go away. Every time there's some kind of national emergency or political travail, the sales of 1984 zoom up.
They were back on the bestseller list this winter for several months.
That's right. But this book is a very good analysis of what Churchill and Orwell did and why, in a sense, they were working for the same thing. They were caught, as the world was, between the extremes of fascism and communism. And they were, Orwell was a communist, and Churchill was definitely not a fascist, but he was very much for liberal democracy. And both of them found common ground there, that the freedom of the individual and a country that is really run by individuals. Orwell put it very well in his books, and Churchill put it on the line in his leadership of England during the Second World War. Neither man was an icon. They're not perfect. But what interesting people, and what an interesting concept of putting the two of them together.
I've read some really good reviews of that book.
Oh, it is a good, good book. And I will lateral that on to you, along with the lexicographer's dilemma. You load books on me, it's going the other way, pal. Those are... do you have any other recommendations of books?
Well, can I read a short story?
You have 2 minutes.
Okay, here it is.
Yes.
It's called Yesterday. This is by Deb Unferth, whose new book of short stories is just out. She's a minimalist.
Okay.
I can do this in 2 minutes. Here it is. The dog and I spent the day in our cages. He and his smaller one, I and my bigger one, and we were quite content. At a certain moment, he grew impatient, and at a different moment, I did. But we were there to comfort each other both times. At night, as night came on, we crouched and listened for the man of the house to come home and rattle our bars. She is so good. I mean, this is, you know, minimalism has sort of become a current fad, but she is really a master at the story that lasts a page. There are some longer stories in this. The book is called Wait Till You See Me Dance. And if you want some light, but not always that light reading,
well, you know,
read Deb Unferth.
In the Twitterverse, that would be a massive tome. What's the name of that collection again?
Wait Till You See Me Dance.
Wait Till You See
Me Unferth, Dance. By Unferth,
Unferth. Oh, my. Well, the idea is that summer's a good time to read, but then any day is. So pull out a book and enjoy the rest of the summer. And come back next week when we'll return for another interview on Scribble.